This is KGNU's Morning Magazine. It's Tuesday, November 2nd. I'm your host, Shannon Young. Thank you for joining us here on listener-supported community radio. Coming up on today's program, agricultural workers marked Day of the Dead with a vigil outside of the Colorado Department of Labor and Employment to honor those who have died on the job and to press for better labor protections. This Week in Water takes a look at what's expected to result from the ongoing climate talks in Glasgow. And we'll play our weekly comment line, comments from listeners who share their thoughts about what they hear on KGNU. At 8:30, How on Earth looks at the environmental impacts of funerals and greener options. At 9 a.m., it's the wit and wisdom of Alan Watts, the British philosopher, writer, and speaker known for interpreting Eastern religious ideas for a Western audience. Then at 9:30, it's the Morning Sound Alternative, 2.5 hours of eclectic music until noon. But first, it's time for local and regional headlines with KGNU's Stacey Johnson.
Court unanimously approved yesterday the new congressional map drawn by the Colorado Independent Congressional Redistricting Commission. The new map establishes the state's 8 U.S. House districts for the next decade and will also apply to next year's election. The Colorado Sun reports the map received challenges from groups claiming it would dilute the power of the Latino voting bloc. The court disagreed. The court also rejected claims that the commission should have drawn more competitive districts, stating the panel needed to prioritize other criteria, including the preservation of communities of interest and political subdivisions over competitiveness. Colorado Jared Polis released his $40 billion budget proposal for the 2022-2023 fiscal year. KGNU's Steve Miller has more.
Governor Polis announced Monday that he wants his budget plan to go towards easing the financial burden of government fees on businesses, reduce homelessness, and combat rising crime. The Colorado Sun reports that the $40 billion budget proposal incorporates state tax revenue and federal coronavirus relief dollars and asks for an 8.5% increase in discretionary spending by the state legislature. Among other items in his proposal is a call for major investments in education and to combat climate change and pollution. Also included is money towards prepaying fees businesses will owe to implement a voters-approved new paid family and medical leave program. The proposal directs money towards public safety, including having behavioral health experts responding to calls with police officers, which has been successful in Denver. The spending plan also aims at reducing homelessness and increase investments towards drug and alcohol treatment. Crime and homelessness are two areas that Republicans are attacking Polis on as he looks for re-election in 2022. I'm Steve Miller for KGNU.
The United States Supreme Court announced yesterday it will not review in an appeals court decision finding 5 Denver police officers deserved qualified immunity in a lawsuit alleging the officers retaliated against a bystander who recorded them using excessive force. According to the Denver Gazette, the case stems from a 2014 incident in which bystander Levi Frazier recorded a Denver police officer punching a suspect in the head while another officer grabbed the suspect's pregnant girlfriend, causing her to fall. Frazier alleged that when he returned to his car, an officer pressed him about the video. He claimed a group of officers later surrounded him until he handed over his recording device for a search. Frazier sued the officers, arguing they retaliated against him for exercising his First Amendment rights. A district court judge declined to grant qualified immunity to the officers after learning Denver police training specifically covers the right of bystanders to record police. The 10th Circuit Court of Appeals earlier this year asserted judicial decisions alone are what places constitutional limitations on the conduct of government employees, not training. Boulder's Best Western Plus Inn near the intersection of 28th and Baseline Road has closed. According to the Daily Camera, the last guest for the hotel's 52-year run checked out on Sunday. The hotel was a hub for visiting CU parents, conference attendees, as well as visitors to the city's federal labs. The Daily Camera reports developers will turn the site into a 92-unit student housing complex called Hub Boulder, making it the latest in a row of student housing along 28th Street. Xcel Energy announced yesterday the utility plans to achieve net zero greenhouse gas emissions from its natural gas business by 2050. The company did not release many details on how it plans to reach the 2050 long-term goal, but said it will cut natural gas emissions in the short term by reducing methane leaks and by purchasing gas only from suppliers with certified low emissions. Colorado Newsline reports over two-thirds of Colorado homes still use natural gas as a primary heating and cooking fuel source. Yesterday's announcement broadened the utility's previous 2018 commitment, pledging 100% carbon-free electricity by the same date. Today's weather for the upper metro Front Range includes a chance of rain and snow showers before noon, then rain showers are likely to occur for the rest of the day and into the evening. Highs will be near 40 with tonight's lows around 33 degrees. The current temperature outside the Boulder studios is 34 degrees. For KGNU, I'm Stacy Johnson.
You are listening to The Morning Magazine on KGNU. Today is Day of the Dead, and while it's not an official holiday in the U.S., it is celebrated by many in the Latin American immigrant diaspora here. Agricultural workers set up a traditional altar outside of the Colorado Department of Labor and Employment yesterday to honor those who have died on the job and to press for better protections. KGNU's Dave Ashton was there and spoke with Dr. Damian Thompson, co-founder of Frontline Farming.
Here we are, Dia de Muertos, celebrating the lives of people that have died in the fields. Yep. You know, what causes you to want to be part of this celebration?
Well, I mean, I think it's just really important always to honor the dead, right? To honor our ancestors, but then also to really, you know, when it comes to ag workers, when it comes to lots of working class people, blue collar people, we do so much work, you know, and it often happens in the background. Not only do people not know that where their food is coming from, but then they also don't know that there are upwards of 50,000 people in Colorado who are doing that farm work who are not officially counted as farmers. And so they give their lives for this work. They sacrifice their long-term health and potentially the long-term health of their families. And then they can also family members lose lives, you know? And so it's really important to kind of come together today, especially because we're standing here out in front of the headquarters of the Colorado Department of Labor as they're inside hearing testimony about the Agricultural Workers' Bill of Rights and what types of rules they should organize. So we're having this vigil to say that, like, well, on this day of Dia de los Muertos, not only are we gonna honor, like, our family, but we're also going to honor these people who are ultimately otherwise invisible and really pay homage to their sacrifice.
When you're eating your salad, it may not occur to you that somebody could be in a life-threatening position for that to get to your plate.
Yeah, or that people wake up, you know, and pull crazy shifts from like 2:30 in the morning until, you know, 5:30 in the evening just harvesting lettuce when it's lettuce harvesting time. So, I mean, not only that, but it's like they're sacrificing life, limb, health, long-term, you know, and then before you have, when you don't have legislation, when you don't have policy, when you don't have rules, in effect, it's not as if every single employer will abuse or take advantage, but it creates the opportunity for it to happen. And so it's less about any individual bad actors, and it's more about a system that allows that kind of exploitation to happen.
Damien, what would you say have been some of the leading causes of death for agricultural workers in Colorado?
Oh, that is not one that I think I can necessarily speak to. Well, for instance, I mean, I guess I can say, to point out an example, this past year, we had Juan Ponzo, who is a Mexican national, who died here in Greeley, in one of the dairies. And so one of the ways that you can get pretty significant injury or death is through the use of machinery that people haven't adequately been trained on. And so what happened in his case is that he wasn't adequately trained in this piece of equipment. It lurched forward, went into one of those manure kind of cesspools, and he, you know, drowned / asphyxiated in the cab. You know, when people are trying to dive in and really did what they could to save him. But that's just an example of the types of work that really prevent, just kind of any kind of industry. You know, when you're talking about meat packing, you can talk about like repetitive stress injuries from making one cut. So like I said, it's kind of important that people also know that just because people don't die, it doesn't mean that they're not significantly impacted. You know, so it's kind of like you have an entire range from long-term health impacts of like diabetes, you know, hypertension, you know, the types of things that people can experience from not having the best diet, the best access to food. So it's really, you know, it's not just like that one-to-one. It's also like, what are the things that are happening to people that we don't even know about because they're experiencing them as like these chronic long-term health conditions too.
You've been doing this work for some time.
Yeah.
Last session, the state legislature passed a bill that would strengthen labor protections for farm workers.
Yep.
What were some of the measures passed and what do you see as some of the progress on their implementation?
Well, some of the major pieces that were passed were protections for workers from retaliation. One of the protections that they have now is the ability to organize themselves and to be represented in terms of labor unions. So that's been important. Another has been the right to overtime. One of the big debates right now in this rulemaking process is that CDLE actually advanced their first set of rules that were not okay. You know, they're not about protecting the health and safety of farm workers, you know? And so overtime, health and safety, so having adequate rest breaks, having access to adequate shade, having access to adequate water, having access to adequate length of time in terms of being able to take breaks. So, you know, those are a few of the places. Actually, one of the other really important ones was the abolition of the short-handled hoe, which is like an 18-inch implement, which essentially forces whoever is using it to work in a stoop position for hours and hours and hours. And it had been abolished since the 1970s in places like Texas, right? So Colorado was one of the last states that actually still had that as a legal farm implement to be used. So really things that weren't even necessary in terms of getting the work, and it just actually seemed like it was cool. So that's one of the things that, those are some of the pieces that the Ag Worker Bill of Rights has started to address. Another big one is access to services. You know, a lot of times ag workers don't have automobiles, they don't have access to steady transportation. So a lot of times if it's health, if it has to do with money in the bank, they have to figure those things out. And they have to figure those things out within the context of a 12-hour workday. So the bill has also allowed for better, more consistent access of those people who are providing services to ag workers so that they can get those services.
That's very interesting. It seems like protections and workers, different areas have pressed forward while the agricultural workers have been kind of left in the dust.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and one of the major arguments against, well, for the Agricultural Workers' Bill of Rights is systematic racism, right? And so one of the arguments about agriculture is that it has historically always had these exclusions. And the argument in return is, well, it's always had these historic exclusions because it's been structured around systematic racism, right? First, the enslavement of Africans, you know, the theft of land from indigenous people. And so we've really been going back to that again and again to say just because, well, rather to say that if your exemptions are rooted in this systematic racism, then these are not exemptions that we can allow to stand, regardless of the impact that it may have on farms. Like it is going to have an impact on farm economies, but that's not a more important issue than the basic human rights of people.
If people are wanting to put a face on the agriculture workers and, you know, people getting them to their food, how can everyday people kind of make them more of a connection?
Well, I mean, I think that one of the most important, well, one of the things you can certainly do to find out about a lot of the work with the Agricultural Workers Bill of Rights is to go visit the Project Protect Food Systems Workers website, projectprotectfoodsystems.org. And there you can find information on the bill. You can find information on the Promotora Network and the amazing network of individuals and people around the state who are actually on the ground advocating for ag workers, supporting ag workers, visiting ag workers, making sure that they get the resources that they need. So that's an awesome opportunity and awesome resource. There's lots of things happening right now that people can get involved in, like in terms of CDLE and the actual rulemaking process.
Thanks for being on KGNU today.
Got it. Thanks, Dave.
That was Dr. Damian Thompson of Frontline Farming speaking with KGNU's Dave Ashton at the Day of the Dead vigil for essential farm workers outside of the Colorado Department of Labor and Employment. You are listening to The Morning Magazine on KGNU. Time now for the latest edition of This Week in Water with Jamie Sudler and Franny Halperin.
A whale of a way to capture carbon. That story and more on H2O Radio's weekly news report. I'm Jamie Sudler.
I'm Franny Halperin, and it's This Week in Water.
The UN Climate Conference, COP26, started in Glasgow, Scotland on Sunday, and many are calling it a make-or-break moment for the planet.
To limit warming, the UN has said that in 8 years' time, nations need to cut in half their releases of CO2 and methane, among other gases, and then reach net zero emissions by 2050.
At Glasgow, governments will negotiate how to report their achievements and be transparent about their progress, or lack of it. One goal is to build trust that each is doing what it needs to.
There will also be discussions about how wealthier countries will fulfill promises to help poorer nations transition away from fossil fuels. Only $100 billion per year has been promised so far, which is a small amount compared to the trillions needed.
Negotiators are also set to discuss carbon pricing, which some see as incentivizing reductions, but others view as not going far enough to limit countries from what are considered weak emissions targets.
The urgency of the task facing world leaders during the two-week conference was highlighted by a UN report that found the world is on track for a temperature rise of at least 2.7 degrees Celsius by the end of the century.
The report also showed that instead of cutting emissions by 50% by 2030, countries may only reach a meager 7.5%. China is refusing to strengthen its commitments to limit global greenhouse gas emissions, as are Russia and India.
The UN has also called for a 50% reduction in carbon emissions from maritime shipping by 2050. The industry accounts for about 3% of global greenhouse gases, more than airplanes. So, how to get there? One possibility is to go electric.
The Yara Birkeland, the world's first zero-emissions autonomous electric cargo ship, is scheduled to set sail between two Norwegian ports in the coming weeks.
The vessel is small. It only carries about 100 containers versus the 20,000 or so that big ships transport, but it could help ease congestion in clogged ports by taking less time to load and unload.
The Yara Birkeland will transport goods for a Norwegian chemical company to destinations by way of the country's fjords instead of by truck, thereby eliminating tailpipe emissions while reducing road traffic.
For now, an electric vessel like the Yara Birkeland is only feasible for short hauls and not crossing oceans. But because it sails autonomously with no fuel costs, the company says its operating budget will be slashed by almost 90%, and that could generate interest from other shippers.
Many natural environments, like forests, soils, and the ocean, store CO2 and keep it from contributing to global warming, but there's also an animal that sequesters a lot of carbon. Whales.
A new report from NOAA and the Greater Faroe Lands Association shows how whales store huge amounts of carbon in their bodies, and when they die, they take it to the bottom of the ocean.
Sinking whale carcasses, or whale falls, sequestered about 60% of the total carbon trapped in the Marine Protected Sanctuary near San Francisco, more than seaweed and seagrass habitat.
It's estimated that whales could sequester almost 2 billion tons of carbon each year if they're allowed to return to the numbers before hunting them began. That could be the equivalent of up to 400,000 cars per year.
Living whales provide ample benefits for the climate, too, such as fertilizing and stimulating the growth of plankton through their iron-rich feces. Those algae capture about 40% of all the CO2 produced in the world.
And finally, when you take a picture of yourself, it's of course a selfie, but have you heard of coasties? Parks Canada, the agency that manages the country's national parks, historic sites, and marine conservation areas, wants you to turn the camera around and take pictures of the shoreline for science.
Coastie photos can be taken from designated spots in 5 national parks in eastern Canada and will be used to monitor changes over time, such as shoreline retreat, dune erosion, ice cover, storm surge, vegetation, and even rip currents.
Then, researchers at the University of Windsor will overlay the photos on maps to quantify coastal changes due to rising sea levels and extreme storms.
For example, scientists have observed nearshore ice decline in Prince Edward Island National Park. Without the natural barrier that ice provides, they expect that erosion in the winter months will increase, and the images will help them test their hypothesis.
At H2O Radio, we think coasties are a cool idea that could be used in our home state of Colorado to measure changes in the Rockies. Do you think Parks Canada would object if we called them Mounties?
That's it for this week in water. But before we go, we want to tell you our annual fundraising campaign has started, where donations will be doubled dollar for dollar now through December 31st. Go to h2oradio.org to give, and thank you.
After COVID shuttered most school gardens last year, more than half of Colorado's school districts are working to give more students access to fresh, nutrient-rich food through farm-to-school programs. Eric Galatis reports.
Farm-to-school programs are beginning to bounce back after last year's COVID closures, and more than half of the state's 178 school districts now have at least one activity aimed at helping students access local, nutrient-rich foods. Jessica Wright with Nourish Colorado is part of a statewide effort to get more school cafeterias connected with local food producers while students learn firsthand where their food comes from.
From planting those seeds, harvesting it, and transporting it to us, and helping these students actually understand that it's not as simple as going to the grocery store and buying an apple. There's a lot of work that goes into that.
Farm-to-school programs give local farmers a reliable revenue stream, and Wright says they can also help more students see food production as a viable long-term career option. For school food directors, farmers, and anyone else interested in learning more about connecting farms to schools, visit nourishcolorado.org to sign up for workshops planned for January. In 2019, Colorado lawmakers passed legislation that helped launch a 3-year pilot program giving schools in 16 diverse districts money to buy Colorado-grown, raised, or processed products. Schools can also get training for preparing healthy meals from scratch. Wright says cost can be a significant barrier for schools operating on tight food budgets.
This is a way to show that if we can provide schools with that financial incentive, they are then buying more local products, creating new connections to our agricultural producers, and really starting to bake this into how they operate.
Wright also sees her work as an opportunity to build more equitable food systems that value farm workers and every other aspect of food production and distribution. She says the education opportunities are virtually endless when classrooms are extended into school gardens and farms.
I mean, there's science, there's math, there's reading, there's history, above and beyond culinary skills, and just the wonder of seeing something grow and getting to taste that hard work right there off the vine, like a freshly picked cherry tomato.
This is Eric Galatis reporting for the Colorado News Connection.
And now we check in with KGNU's comment line and the listeners who share their thoughts on what they hear on KGNU.
This is Robert Davis. I listen to Alan Watts. Occasionally, you have an idiot running things who runs a commercial in between Alan Watts and the Morning Sound Alternatives. Most of the time, you do a smooth segue from Watts to the music, which is the way it should be for those of us who are meditating. And I contribute to the station mainly for this purpose.
At 6:20 p.m. and the program Hemispheres is going, I'm listening to it on the Denver station, and it disappears. It's gone off the air now. Thank you.
And that's all the time we have for today's Morning Magazine. If you would like to make a listener comment just like those that you heard, you can give us a call at 303-447-9911. We play those messages back on Tuesday morning. Special thanks to Stacey Johnson, Steve Miller, Dave Ashton, Jamie Sudler, Franny Halperin, and Alexis Kenyon for their help on today's program. I've been your host, Shannon Young. Stay tuned for How on Earth, but that's coming up just after these news headlines from the BBC.